You ready?
Ready?
Ready? Ready? Watch out, Frank!
The following podcast features views and opinions that are not representative of the collective views of the Whispers groups. Some of these views may not be suitable for children. Accordingly, the producers and hosts of the Missy AE podcast must insist that no one attempt to take anything that is being said as representative of the views of any of the Whispers groups.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of the Missy AE podcast. Tonight, we bring to you Sports Whispers Weekly, where we will talk nothing but sports for the duration of the show. I am Steve Kent. As always, I am joined with me by Lou, and we have a lot on the plate tonight. We have coaching changes that have taken place throughout all of college football. We have some problems out in Arizona involving the Arizona Coyotes. It's bad enough they suck as a hockey team this season, but apparently things have gotten worse now. As in, they can't even pay their lease, so to speak. We also have the unfortunate news about Demaryius Thomas that we will discuss as well. We have also tonight the Games Gridiron, our game that we have in Sports Whispers. We will be doing our Bowl Bonanza picks live officially on the air tonight. And the reason why I'm doing so is because, Lou, obviously, you know, every week I send you the spreads for the Games Gridiron. Normally you pick seven games. However, this one is kind of a bit too much for it to be over text because there are 33 bowl games. There are 33 bowl games that have been selected. And
is that all?
The both of us are going to have to pick all 33.
Wow. I do mine in two parts. I did the first week this week, and I'll do the rest of my for next week's show on my show. So, because I knew I'd be able to get all of them done within the allotted time. Oh, just to clarify, Arizona had paid it all off. It was a case of human error that screwed it up. So they are going to be able to stay in their home arena through the remainder of the season.
That's what that whole thing was human error, because
that's what it was blamed on.
Originally, it said that the city of Glendale had informed the Coyotes that they would be kicked out of the Gila River Arena on December 20th if they failed to pay their still outstanding taxes, as supposedly they owed about $1.3 million, including $250,000 to the city of Glendale itself, according to a letter from the city manager to the team. And also there was an unpaid balance as well for the 2020-2021 season. And
correct.
The Coyotes, they did, like you said, apparently it was due to human error. The Coyotes did issue a response, a statement in response to the letter. And basically, it says that they are current on all their bills as of now and owe no state or local taxes whatsoever. But first off, this shouldn't even be, you know, this shouldn't even come up, period. You know, if you're an NHL team,
never should have happened.
If you're a professional team, this should already be locked down to begin with. You know, everything should be, basically, if you're a professional team, whoever's in charge of your finances should be on the ball with this stuff. Apparently, it was due to human error. I guess I don't. Did they say if it was from the Coyotes' side or if it was from the city of Glendale's side?
I believe it's still the city of Glendale.
Okay, so I mean, they must have. They must have quite the crew, I guess, in the city of Glendale to be able to screw up something like that.
They screwed up all right.
Especially with one of their top teams. It's funny considering them a top team when they absolutely suck this year.
Yes.
But we do have some breaking news. Bryce Young is the Heisman Trophy winner.
Yeah.
The first quarterback in Alabama history to win the title of the Heisman Trophy, and he is also the fourth player overall to win it for Nick Saban, which ties a college record. For four Heisman Trophy winners to be produced by one coach. And you know, Lou, it kind of makes sense when you take a look at the numbers. Bryce Young this year, he as I said last week, he had very eerily similar stats compared to Mac Jones. And like I said last week, if it wasn't for Devontae Smith's huge season, crazy season that he had in college last year, Mac Jones probably would have won the Heisman as well. But
yeah, who'll get rookie of the year this year though?
Oh yeah, he'll get. Especially with how Jamar Chase has performed recently, I think even though Mac Jones only completed, and you know what, we're going to talk about this in a little bit too, the fact that Mac Jones only threw three passes in the game against the Buffalo Bills. I don't really think it should affect his standing that much when it comes to Rookie of the Year, because I mean, he was simply following a game plan. And I mean, let's face it, when you're in playing in those conditions, it's not going to be a passing game. I mean, let's just put it then and there right now. It's not going to be a passing game, period.
No.
But Bryce Young, he did have similar stats to Mac Jones in Mac Jones' final year from Alabama last year. He had slightly less passing yards, 4,322, compared to about, I think it was 4,500. I think it was 4,500 that Mac Jones had to end his Alabama career. I think it was somewhere around there. He did have slightly more touchdowns, though, 43 compared to 41 for Mac. He had the same amount of interceptions, 4 picks thrown this season, and he had an 88.9 quarterback rating, which was good for second in all of. And he also completed 68% of his passes this season, which is lower than Mac Jones last year, but still, you know, these are Heisman Trophy numbers for Bryce Young. And, you know, I stated this last week as well, but the game against Auburn, in my opinion, was Bryce Young's Heisman Trophy game.
It was. There was reports about that.
Where they had, you know, he had to show, okay, what kind of player am I under crucial situations? And I mean, we saw it clear as day what he was able to do to get Alabama back in the game and then eventually force it to 4 overtimes, where they ended up winning 24-22 at the time. Even though he didn't have the best game completion-wise, I mean, 25 of 51 that game, but he did recover, put up 317 yards, completed 49% of his passes, two touchdowns, one pick that game. And obviously we saw what he did against Georgia last week, 26 of 44, 421 yards, three touchdowns, an average of 9.6 yards per throw. I mean, I honestly think it was a no-brainer. And quite frankly, the only other person I feel that was really much of a threat would be C.J. Stroud, who was one of the
I was saying the same thing.
But actually, Stroud finished in fourth in Heisman voting.
What about the kid from Michigan? That they thought he was a high candidate too.
Yes, he came in second. Aiden Hutchinson had 954 points.
Hutchinson.
Pittsburgh's quarterback Kenny Pickett came in third with 631 points, and Stroud had 399, but Young ran away with it with 2,311. So,
yeah.
I mean, it wasn't really that close. Compared to, I do find it interesting though that a defensive player came in second.
Yeah.
Because usually you're not used to defensive players being up for the Heisman. Usually it's on the offensive side of the ball. But anyways, Bryce Young, he did end up taking home the Heisman Trophy this year, making it, I believe, what, the second straight Alabama player to do so?
Yes.
So it's definitely, I'll tell you one thing, it definitely, it would have raised his draft stock, but apparently he may be staying at Alabama for another year. So Maybe perhaps
unusual
we could have a potential
age.
Repeat. We could have a potential repeat next year, possibly.
Archie Griffith.
But anyways, you know what? Considering how many games we have to get to here, I figure we should probably get started on the bowl picks. Because there's quite a few. And actually, let me bring up real quick. I have my I already made my picks earlier today in Sports Whispers,
right.
But I'm gonna bring my list up here as well. So we will start with the first game, which is the PUBG Mobile New Mexico Bowl that will take place on. It's one of the three bowl games that will take place on the 18th next Saturday. We have the UTEP Miners against the Fresno State Bulldogs, and Fresno State is an 11-point favorite.
Fresno State.
Yeah, you know, I had a feeling you were probably going to take Fresno, and I have to agree because UTEP, we didn't really see much out of UTEP. I don't think UTEP was barely even covered this year when it came to football coverage. How about we got BYU against the UAB Blazers, and BYU is favored by 7.
Going with the Cougars.
I also went that way as well. I went with BYU. I mean, it's UAB. They didn't really match up against too many people.
They never do.
Against too many teams that I recognized. How about that by the way was the Radiance Technologies Independence Bowl. That will take place at 3:30 Eastern. The Fresno State game will take place at 2:15 Eastern on next Saturday.
There is a game on the 17th, though, Steve.
Is there?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this isn't one of the games though that was listed for Sports Whispers.
Okay.
It might be because actually, let me take a look. Tim said that there wasn't a spread listed for that game.
Okay.
How about the Jimmy Kimmel LA Bowl? We have the Utah State Aggies as 7-point underdogs to the Oregon State Beavers.
Beavers. Jimmy Kimmel gets a bowl game.
Yeah.
Johnny Carson never got one either, but you got Jimmy Kimmel?
Yeah, kind of surprising. I guess, you know, in this day and age, though, I mean, hell, Barstool Sports has a bowl game this year. So,
what
you know,
weird?
I
what
guess...
Be weird?
I guess in this day and age, you know,
media
personalities have a much bigger influence than people think.
Oh, is that why we haven't got our own yet? Because we're not that big yet. Okay. Next.
I guess. I don't know. But on Wednesday the 22nd, we have the Lockheed Martin Armed Forces Bowl, which will be the Missouri Tigers as 3-point underdogs against the Army Black Knights.
Army.
I chose Army, too. And by the way, I chose Utah State to take over Oregon State.
Ooh.
For the L.A. Bowl. I got a feeling, considering how close some of Utah State's games have been this year.
Right.
Then the next day, we have the Union Home Mortgage Armed Forces Bowl between the Central Florida Knights and the Florida Gators. Now, the Florida Gators, they are favored by 7 points.
All I can say is watch out for that alligator.
So you're going with Florida?
Yes.
All right. I was very back and forth on this one. I ultimately ended up going with Florida because I don't know. I still think that Florida historically has been more of an offensive school compared to defense, and considering, you know, Central Florida, their games have been relatively close this year. But I feel that Florida will fight. I think Florida finished at 500, right? They were 6-6, I believe.
Yes.
So I would assume that Florida, especially with them going through a whole bunch of different things, that they're probably going to they're probably going to hopefully get things together for this matchup. And I ended up going with Florida. I ended up going with Florida as well in this one. What about Memphis taking on the Hawaii Rainbow Warriors in the Easy Post Hawaii Bowl? And believe it or not, even though it's mentioned as a Hawaii Bowl, Memphis is favored by 7.
Well, aloha on that one. So I'm going to go with Memphis.
All right. And I also went with Memphis as well. Memphis has, well, you know, I follow one of the fans of the Memphis Tigers who happens to be in sports broadcasting as well. So, so I have a pretty good idea of where Memphis would stand in this matchup, and I got a pretty good feeling that Memphis will quite possibly cover in this one.
All right.
So how about the Tax Act Camellia Bowl, which takes place on 2 Saturdays from tonight, so on the 25th, on Christmas Day, actually. The Tax Act Camellia Bowl, we have the Georgia State Panthers going against the Ball State Cardinals, and Georgia State is favored by 4.5.
I hate to sound like a bad pump from an ACDC song, but they got the biggest balls of them all.
So Ball State Cardinals it is. Yes. And this was another one I kind of flopped back and forth on, but I ended up going with Georgia State for this matchup.
Oh, okay.
Slightly better statistics, but just slightly. Although, obviously, though, with bowl games, you know, things can get thrown out the window completely. I mean, we saw it with we saw it between Army and Navy earlier today. You know, Navy finished with like a 3-8 record.
Well, you did, but I have another game.
Well, to put it simply, Army came with a much better record, yet they got upset by Navy.
Yeah.
All right. Our next matchup, we have the Western Michigan Broncos in the Quick Lane Bowl. They are 3.5-point favorites over the Nevada Wolfpack.
That one, I don't think I think I'm going to go. Wait. It's Nevada who again?
Nevada Wolfpack. Nevada Wolfpack against Western Michigan.
Huh. No, I've got to go
and,
Western Michigan.
All right, yeah. You know, I ended up going with Western Michigan, too, and the reason being is even though Nevada is 8-4, there is a question mark as to whether or not their star quarterback, Carson Strong, will be able to play, as he's pretty much I guess he's dealing with some sort of injury right now. He ended up suffering, and He said he currently isn't sure as to whether or not he'll be eligible to play, or whether he'll be able to play. But he had a strong, no pun intended, strong season this year for Carson Strong with 36 touchdowns and eight picks, over 4,100, close to 4,200 passing yards as a junior out of Nevada. So if he's out, it will be a much different game. And Western Michigan, I would not be surprised at all if they ultimately end up taking it. And I did choose Western Michigan because of that, because I'm not entirely sure whether or not Strong will be active for that matchup.
Yeah.
We also have the Military Bowl, which is presented by Paraton. And in that, we have the Boston College Eagles as 3.5-point favorites against East Carolina, against the East Carolina Pirates. Agreed. I think, especially with BC having their top quarterback back, it's going to be they've been playing a lot better recently compared to that stretch of games where they ended up losing six straight. So I agree with that. I ended up choosing Boston College as well in this one.
Yeah.
Next up, we have the Ticket Smarter Birmingham Bowl, which pits the Houston Cougars against the Auburn Tigers, and the Auburn Tigers are favored by 3.
Houston, you won't have a problem here.
You got Houston?
Yes.
All right. You took Houston. I ended up taking the Auburn Tigers. And why? Because of one reason. The SEC. The SEC, even though they're 6-6, a much tougher schedule. And usually they do well in bowl games, I believe. If I recall correctly from previous years. Our next matchup is the Serve Pro First Responder Bowl. We have the Air Force Falcons, who are 1.5-point underdogs to the Louisville Cardinals.
I'm going to go with Louisville this year. I've been impressed with them this year, so I'm going to take them.
All right, I ended up going with Air Force, and the only reason being is because Air Force has always burned me every single time I've had the app. I've been thinking of potentially taking them in a game this year.
Uh-huh.
I've always ended up going the opposite route, and they always burn me every single time. So with that being, I went with Air Force for this one.
Okay.
For the AutoZone Liberty Bowl, we have the Mississippi State Bulldogs against the Texas Tech Red Raiders. And the Bulldogs, they are favored by 8.5.
Bulldogs.
Yeah. I don't think that one is much of a question. I had the Bulldogs as well start. I had the Bulldogs right from the start. Quite possibly one of the – well, apart from the Alabama pick, which no shocker there, I picked Alabama. Apart from the Alabama pick, the Mississippi State pick was probably one of the quickest picks that I made for my matchup. Now we have the San Diego County Credit Union Holiday Bowl, which is – between the UCLA Bruins against the NC State Wolfpack, and the Wolfpack, they are favored by 1 point.
If it was basketball, I would take the Wolfpack, but this is football, so I'm going with UCLA.
UCLA, all right.
Yes.
And I ended up choosing
I'll bet I know.
Which one here? I ended up taking the Wolfpack in this one.
I knew it.
Oh, by the way, this just in, Tim from Sports Whispers actually just sent this through to me. Joe Judge apparently has been retained for another year in the New York Giants head coach.
Bad move.
I'm kind of surprised because he's been on the bubble, and you know, he appeared like he was going to be one of the favorites actually to potentially get fired this year.
That's what we were hoping for,
but instead, I guess. I don't know. You know, management must believe in what he's doing, but so far, you know,
stupid.
Considering even though he was a former special teams coordinator for the Patriots for many years, I'm not that impressed with what he's done this year. You know, he still has the opportunity to maybe perhaps finish above 500 if they win the remaining five games that they have. But
it's remotely possible, but I wouldn't bet.
Yeah, I wouldn't really put any stock in that potentially happening. I mean, they did have a 6-10 record last year, second in the NFC East, and it's funny that I say second because only in the NFC East can you have a below 500 record and still somewhat be in the playoff race.
Yeah. Well, the whole division sucked, actually. I mean, the best thing anybody did was Washington, and they had a losing record. So the whole division sucked.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say Washington, because Washington is actually in the driver's seat right now. Not the NFC East. The NFC East is Dallas, but Washington in particular, when you consider all of the other NFC East teams besides Dallas, Washington is in the driver's seat right now for a playoff spot.
I know. We gotta beat them.
Because you got the Eagles and, I mean, let's face it, the Giants, they're so far down there. I don't even see them beating the Chargers this week. So, you know.
Neither do I.
The Eagles, maybe they have an opportunity at 6-7. They still have a shot of potentially squeaking in there, considering how even the 6-7 spots are. I mean, nobody's going to catch the Rams for number five. Rams are 8-4, so nobody's going to catch the Rams for number five. Number five is pretty much locked in. 6-7 are still up for grabs, though, and I wouldn't be surprised if another NFC East team, like, say, the Eagles, could potentially sneak in there, especially with the struggles that Jimmy Garoppolo has been having with the 49ers.
Has he ever.
All right, on to our next matchup. We have the Guaranteed Rate Bowl. This will be between the West Virginia Mountaineers and the Minnesota Golden Gophers, and Minnesota is favored by 4.
I'm still going to go with Mountaineers.
All right, so we have the Mountaineers, and I ended up going with Minnesota. I don't know why. I wonder if this was just one of the games that I just threw away, because I had no idea who I would even pick. I don't know. So I ended up going with Minnesota, though, in this matchup. Let's see. The Fenway Bowl pits the SMU Mustangs against the Virginia Cavaliers, and the Mustangs are, or actually, no, the Cavaliers are favored by 1.5.
Even though it's small, I'm still going to go with the Cavaliers.
All right, Cavaliers, and I ended up going with the Mustangs for this one, which I have a feeling it may possibly be a loss now that I think a little bit more about it. Because I ended up, when I turned my picks in, I turned them in earlier today, like really early, before I really had much time to dissect a lot of them. Our next matchup, which will be in the New Era Pinstripe Bowl, we have the Maryland Terrapins as 1-point favorites over the Virginia Tech Hokies.
Virginia Tech.
Virginia Tech?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I ended up going with Maryland simply because of the season that Tua's brother was having at quarterback. There were just so many big plays made by him this year. I mean, yeah, Maryland, you know, wasn't really in the hunt for the college football playoff or even to be ranked, but you know, it's kind of sneaky. I would not be shocked if Tua's brother potentially transfers out at one point or another. I think he's got about, what, 2 more years, I think?
Something like that, yes.
So I wouldn't be shocked at all. But I went with Maryland on this one, though. How about the Cheez-It Bowl? We have the Clemson Tigers as 1-point underdogs against the Iowa State Cyclones.
Clemson.
Though yes, I'm disappointed 100%.
This year because, they've been disappointed
because
this year, but I still think they have a chance to win this.
Yes, no, I agree. I immediately went with Clemson because they really picked up their game after the slow start to the year. And they essentially finished, I think it was, 9-3 or something? 9-3, 8-4, something like that. So, I mean, they had a slow start to the year, but they eventually picked things up. You know, it seemed like their offense was really starting to find an identity. But, you know, they essentially were out of, out of contention at that point in time. I think they ended up finishing the season unranked, actually. So, it's still, even though they're plus one, they're underdogs by a point, I still think they overtake Iowa State. Now, this next one could be potentially a toughie. You have the Oregon Ducks in the Valero Alamo Bowl. The Oregon Ducks as 4.5-point underdogs to the Oklahoma Sooners.
Ooh. Oregon, Oklahoma. Wow. Oregon by a slight margin.
So you do think Oregon will cover?
Yes. I think it's going to be a closer game than most people think.
All right. I did end up going with I agree with you. I think this one will be very close. However, I did go with Oklahoma, considering they finished just slightly behind Oklahoma State this year, to the point of where it looked like it may be a potential rematch between the two for their championship, their respective conference championship. But ultimately, you know, they ended up falling to the Cowboys, so that essentially erased everything. But I did end up going with the Sooners in this matchup. Kind of close, but even though the Sooners don't have Lincoln Riley anymore,
yes,
you got to think that they're probably playing for some sort of way to salvage the season. All right. now we're heading into the December 30th, starting with the Duke's Mayo Bowl. We have the North Carolina Tar Heels as 7-point favorites over the South Carolina Gamecocks.
Yeah, another one that sounds like a good basketball matchup. I'm going to go with North Carolina, though.
I agree. I went with North Carolina simply because, there were many games this year that South Carolina could have potentially won, or on paper, it looked like that it was a sure thing that they would probably win, and they just completely shat the bed on some of the matchups that, there were still people in Sports Whispers that were picking them, and I was like, why are you guys going with South Carolina? That's pretty much almost a guaranteed loss for Games Gridiron that week.
Yes.
Because for the most part, they were either blown out or they would lose close games. So I agree with you, though, on this one. I ended up going with the Tar Heels as well. The next one we have is the Trans Perfect Music City Bowl, which pits the Tennessee Volunteers against the Purdue Boilermakers, and they have Tennessee as a 4.5-point favorite.
Yeah, go with Tennessee.
All right, you will go with Tennessee, and I think considering Purdue had an upset earlier this year, I am going with Purdue for this one. I think Purdue pulls off the upset because Tennessee, usually when it comes to bowls or the playoffs in general, that's when they start to choke. So I would not be shocked at all if Tennessee ends up blowing this one. That, and also considering what happened earlier this year, I'm still sort of sour on that, involving the fans and everything. All right, next, let's see, we're more than halfway done here. Next, we have the Pittsburgh Panthers in the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl. The Pittsburgh Panthers are 1.5-point underdogs to the Michigan State Spartans.
Spartans.
I agree. I had Michigan State as well here. And Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh's one of those schools that even though they were highly ranked at one point this year, they never really got much attention.
No.
So, it's much different when you're facing high level schools like the surging Michigan State Spartans have this year. So,
yes.
And considering how Michigan State fared, I feel comfortable going with Michigan State in this matchup as well. Now we have the SRS Distribution Las Vegas Bowl. That will pit the Wisconsin Badgers against the Arizona State Sun Devils, and Wisconsin is favored by 7.
ASU.
You are going with Arizona State?
I am.
All righty. Arizona State, and I went with Wisconsin in this one. Hmm. Let's see. The Tax Slayer Gator Bowl. We have the Wake Forest Demon Deacons as 7-point underdogs to the Texas A&M Aggies.
I gotta go with Texas A&M.
Yes, I agree with this one as well. Texas A&M, especially considering the upset that they had earlier this year over Alabama, Alabama's only loss on the season. I didn't see Wake Forest pull off any of those upsets.
It was a basketball game, yes, it'd be Wake Forest, but this is not basketball.
Yeah, exactly. So I went with Texas A&M as well in this one. Let's see, the Tony the Tiger Sun Bowl. We have the Washington State Cougars as 2.5-point underdogs against the Miami Hurricanes.
I'm going to go with Miami.
Agreed. I definitely went with Miami in this one. Miami.
It'll be great.
I mean, let's face it. Miami, much better defense. Because they're primarily known to be a defensive school. So
you did get that, didn't you?
Yeah, Tony the Tiger.
Yeah, you got that right. Yeah, I had to do it.
Yeah.
I'm old.
Because they're great. All right, we have next is the Barstool Sports Arizona Bowl. The Central Michigan Chippewas as 8.5-point underdogs to the Boise State Broncos.
Central Michigan. Okay, Taylor, I'll go with your Central Michigan Chippewas. Yes.
All right, Central Michigan. Let's see. I don't think any one of our Whispers people have picked Central Michigan yet, so you will be the first one.
Yeah, the lone one.
I ended up going with Boise State in this one. Let's see. This next matchup, we have the college football playoff semifinal for the Goodyear Cotton Bowl Classic between the Cincinnati Bearcats and the Alabama Crimson Tide, and Cincinnati has a 13.5-point cushion as the underdog.
You know, I know what a lot of people are thinking. They're thinking Alabama, but you know what? I see something here with the Bearcats, so I'm going to go with Cincinnati.
All right, Cincinnati. I ended up going with Alabama. But Cincinnati, I mean, if they, you know, if they're able to have that high, to get that high-powered offense in gear, we saw Alabama at times this year give up, big numbers. So
yes,
it is entire, especially with Alabama losing Jameson Williams, I believe, for the rest of the football playoff. I think it is entirely possible. Honestly, you know, I think Cincinnati, even if they don't win, I think Cincinnati could potentially cover in this scenario.
Yeah.
But I did end up going with the Crimson Tide here. How about the other college football playoff semifinal? At the Capital One Orange Bowl, you have the Georgia Bulldogs against the Michigan Wolverines. And Georgia is a 7.5-point favorite.
Huh. You know, until last week, I thought Georgia was going to be a lock, but I think we're going to go Michigan here.
All right, well, you know, I kind of see why. You know, Michigan is the number two rank, and Georgia, you know, they kind of got exposed, I guess you could say, against Alabama. Considering
yes,
that Georgia hadn't really faced off this season against too many big teams. So I can kind of see when it comes to, you know, putting up, being put up against Michigan, I could kind of see where Michigan could potentially win. I am kind of curious, though, because Michigan, even though they blew out Iowa last week, I mean, let's face it, Iowa, their 10-3 record is a little suspect considering some of the horrible games that they've put up this year. But I mean, this is a matchup between two 12-1 teams, Michigan and Georgia. Either team could very conceivably win this one. But I think Georgia does rebound after their loss to Alabama, and I ended up going with Georgia for this one. All right, how about the Outback Bowl, which takes place on New Year's Day, January 1st. We have the Penn State Nittany Lions as a two-point favorite over the Arkansas Razorbacks.
Penn State.
I ended up going with Arkansas when you take into account the improvements that have been done at Arkansas within the last couple of years. And they finished actually this year, I believe, with their highest record since Brett Bielema was in charge, I believe. Or the early Brett Bielema years, I should say. But okay, Penn State. Let's see, the PlayStation Fiesta Bowl. We have the Notre Dame Fighting Irish as a two-point favorite over the Oklahoma State Cowboys.
I'm going to go Notre Dame.
I agree with this one. I ended up going Notre Dame as well. Any other team, I probably would have gone Oklahoma State, but they have kind of slowed down recently after they ended up beating the Sooners a couple of weeks ago. But I agree, I ended up going with Notre Dame for this one, especially considering they just finished just on the outside of the college football playoff. Next, we have the Verbo Citrus Bowl between the Iowa Hawkeyes and the Kentucky Wildcats.
Iowa.
I agree with this one. I ended up going Iowa as well. They have a bounce back game like we have seen this season. Usually they have a bounce back game after being embarrassed like they were. So I went with Iowa as well. Next game is the Rose Bowl presented by Capital One Venture X. We have the Utah Utes as 6.5-point underdogs to the Ohio State Buckeyes.
Ohio State.
Yeah, not much of a surprise here. I went with Ohio State as well. With Stroud at quarterback, I find it hard to believe that they end up losing this matchup. The All-State Sugar Bowl, we have the Baylor Bears taking on the Ole Miss Rebels, and Baylor is favored by 1 point.
Baylor.
And I went with Baylor as well in this matchup. And our final bowl game to pick from, the Tax Act Texas Bowl. This will be between the LSU Tigers, who are 1-point underdogs, against the Kansas State Wildcats.
LSU.
I went with LSU as well, considering Coach O is no longer a part of LSU.
Right.
Maybe perhaps they play this game with the remaining players play this game with a bit of I don't know if momentum or inspiration, I guess. Considering they no longer have to take direction from Coach O.
Right.
All right. Well, I have just submitted those picks, and I will lock them in right now into the document that we have. So 33 picks, and Lou, the reason why we do this is because it basically, there's been seasons where maybe there's somebody that is low on the totem pole when it comes to the leaderboard and whatnot.
Yeah.
And we've seen it, believe it or not, we have seen winners get crowned at the end of the season.
Wow.
thanks to the bowl bonanza.
Right.
Because they did well in the bowl bonanza with their bowl bonanza picks, either they climbed up back into the hunt, or if somebody ends up so well in the bowl bonanza and they're high up on the list, oftentimes we see it where this actually separates players from each other in the standings. So,
got it.
I mean, right now, Lou, you are currently, let me double check here. You are currently, I believe, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You are in 9th place right now out of 24. Yeah. So you're only six points behind the leader. So it's entirely possible that you could catch up and very quickly here with this one. I mean, you're doing slightly better than I am. You have one more point than I do right now currently in the standings. Well, you know, a couple of either one game, one win weeks, or I don't think I had 0 wins any weeks this week or this year so far. So, you know, that's what happens when you have a couple of either one win or two win weeks. You kind of fall behind. I mean, hell, I think our lowest score right now is 37. Our lowest score is 37. That somebody has, and that's simply because of a lack of or a whole bunch of bad luck, basically, when some people make their picks. But you know, staying in college football, we have some news in regards to coaching changes that have taken place this week. It was announced, I believe, right around the beginning of the week, either Monday or Tuesday, that Oregon's head coach is reportedly taking Manny Diaz's place at Miami after he was informed on Monday morning that he was being let go. And Mario Cristobal, who was the Oregon coach, he had informed his team that he was reportedly departing for Miami. And the buyout for Diaz in this is $8 million that Miami has to pay Diaz. And Cristobal has actually led Oregon to a bowl game in each of his 4 seasons, where they went 2-2 in bowl games under Mario Cristobal. So this is, you know, maybe perhaps with the success that Oregon has had, not just in bowl games, but also in terms of the regular season, maybe perhaps this coaching change could be the kickstart that the Miami Hurricanes need. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, story? I think it might too. This could be exactly what they need.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely a booster, I feel, for especially for, you know, for a club, for a college that's looking to get back to the top or towards the top where they always hung around. You know, just in recent years, they've been towards the middle of the pack, if anything. I don't think they've even been ranked the last couple of years.
To my knowledge, they have not.
Yeah, no, I don't think they have. And according to multiple local and national outlets, speaking of coaching changes, they have also reported that Nevada head coach Jay Norville has reportedly accepted the head coaching position with Colorado State. and this is considered to be a stunner amongst the college football spectrum, because Norvell basically rebuilt Nevada into a legitimate contender in their conference for the first time since they had joined from the WAC in 2012. And over the past 4 years, Nevada went 30-17 with wins over P5 opponents Cal, Purdue, and Oregon State. This year, they're 8-4, and obviously led by a potential first-round quarterback in Carson Strong. Norvell now takes over for Steve Adazio, who was the former Boston College coach, who failed to turn around Colorado State's recent downswing. And the Rams had recently opened a $220 million stadium, and they have made it clear that they have ambitions of joining a P5 conference. So basically, being able to hire Jay Norvell away from Nevada is quite the aggressive move in their push to try and move up in the world of college football. I mean, what do you think about that, Lou? You know, Colorado State trying to make moves here.
Colorado State doesn't really strike as much of a strong football program. I mean, that really goes to their in-state rival, you know, the Colorado Buffaloes. So, I guess it will make room for improvement, though, because they could certainly use it.
Oh, yeah, it'll definitely – I mean, we saw what Jay Norvell was able to do with Nevada since becoming Nevada's head coach. So if he can do that at Nevada, think about what he could potentially do for Colorado State.
And how are we to find out?
So that could be something. That could be something to keep an eye on moving forward. Obviously, they're not going to be, in terms of, we're not going to be seeing them get ranked anytime soon. But they could be. They could be at least improving to, maybe perhaps they end up getting into a football bowl or something. But speaking of coaches, and we talked about Clemson earlier, we talked about Oklahoma earlier with Lincoln Riley leaving. Reportedly, they have found his successor, as former Clemson defensive coordinator Brent Venables will be the next head coach at Oklahoma. And, I mean, this pretty much became breaking news when eyes started popping up when all of a sudden the athletic director of Oklahoma visited the home of Brent Venables. Pretty sure he isn't there just to have a little chit chat with him. It's more than likely unofficial business. Now, this will be considered a homecoming for Venables, as he served as a co-defensive coordinator from 99 to 2003, and then defensive coordinator from 2004 to 2011 for Oklahoma. And during his time with Clemson, he built a storied defense that would finish as one of the best in the country on an annual basis. He was consistently offered head coaching positions, but always elected to stay at Clemson, and he was rewarded by being made the highest paid assistant in college football. So basically, he was almost being paid as a head coach just to be a defensive coordinator. That's kind of like what we're seeing with the Patriots and Josh McDaniels being the offensive coordinator with New England. And I guess he's been waiting all this time to have the opportunity to coach for Oklahoma. And once the opportunity arose, that is the one head coaching opportunity that he finally took. So what are your thoughts, Lou, with Brent Venables leaving Clemson to head over to the SEC with Oklahoma?
Oh dear, another one jumping ship. It seems like we're seeing a lot of that, not just with schools now, coaches and everything, going up from one conference to another. You know, it's just baffling. I mean, why do they think that this is going to make this conference better? You know, look, I mean, I've seen conferences before where they switch thinking they're going to get more money, more TV time, and maybe better results on the playing field. It doesn't always work out that way. So this is just another example of what could be a big, tragic mistake.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible that could be a big mistake. But you know, who knows? Venables, with him going to a big school like Oklahoma, could potentially be, you know, you could still have that recruiting power, considering the stuff he was able to do for Clemson's defense for so many years. Maybe perhaps Oklahoma becomes more of a defensive team. All right, now before we go into some more news about football, I want to talk about the Patriots matchup against the Buffalo Bills last week, because this may have been one of the more bizarre games that we've seen in recent memory. This was almost reminiscent of the Wind Bowl, I like to call it, the Wind Bowl back in 2008 between these two clubs, where literally the goalposts were hanging down to one side of the field, or to one side of the post. Like, it literally looked like the field was completely tilted on its side. And obviously we didn't see it happen this week, but it was still a very windy game. They had 25 to 35 mile per hour sustained winds with gusts of up to 55 miles per hour. And I don't think people understand, you know, a lot of people have said, well, the Patriots, the Patriots didn't allow Mac Jones to throw more than three pass attempts, so they must have questions about his arm. No, you dumbasses. It's because it was a windy game. Most of the time, Mac was playing against the wind. And did you get to watch the game, Lou?
I think I did see a little bit of it. I don't think we will see the whole game in this area.
Well, let me put it to you this way. There were, well, hell, I'll just bring up this example. They were, during practice, they were doing field goal attempts from various distances.
I see.
When Tyler Bass went to do a field goal attempt, and I think he was kicking with the wind, with the wind at his back, he kicked from 29 yards and he kicked from 34 yards. He missed both attempts in a comedic fashion. It's like literally once that ball went in the air, all of a sudden the wind basically carried it with the wind, which the wind was going at an eastern direction for pretty much the entire evening, going through into the night hours. So it was, needless to say, you know, there was a question at first as to whether or not this game may have potentially been postponed until the next day on Tuesday because of how bad the weather conditions were.
Yes.
But ultimately, they ended up playing the game. And, you know, for a team that thrives on turnovers, they ended up ultimately facing a team that has been probably one of the best in recent weeks at limiting turnovers. So New England, you know, that obviously on both sides, this game was pretty much primarily a running game. Well, actually, no. Buffalo, because they played mostly with the wind towards their backs, Buffalo was the primarily passing unit. Considering they got absolutely stuffed on the run all night long. Their lead rusher was Josh Allen for 39 yards on 6 carries. Otherwise, Allen completed half of his pass attempts, 15 for 30, 145 yards and a touchdown throw. But really, that one touchdown throw was only because N'Keal Harry apparently didn't understand that when the wind is drastically affecting the way the football sails, you probably shouldn't be trying to field punt attempts. And the reason why Buffalo was able to score was because the ball went, it slightly grazed the N'Keal Harry's helmet, which essentially made it a live ball. And Buffalo ended up recovering it. Otherwise, this game probably would have been 14-3, maybe 14-0.
Yeah.
But Stephon Diggs, no surprise, he was the lead receiver for Buffalo. 4 catches, 51 yards. Gabriel Davis had 2 catches for 30 yards, including a touchdown grab, which was the only touchdown for Buffalo. Over on the Patriots side, primarily a running game. Mac Jones only had 2 of 3 passes for 19 yards, which was actually – it actually set a new New England Patriots record for the fewest amount of throws made in a game. But Damian Harris, he had a pretty huge game, 10 carries, 111 yards for 1 touchdown, which that was on a 64-yard rush after he broke through the defense in the first quarter that originally put up New England 7-0. Or actually, no, it was 8-0 because they converted the 2-point attempt. Ramondre Stevenson, he had 24 carries for 78 yards after Harris ended up going down with an injury. Good news is for the Patriot fans, though, it sounds like it's not going to be anything to worry about long term because he was made available to speak to the media. And normally, if somebody has a serious injury, they do not allow them to talk to the media afterwards.
Right.
Brandon Bolden, he had 4 carries for 28 yards. He also had a 7-yard catch as well, which was part of a screen pass. We also saw a couple of other players. Nelson Aguilar had a short carry for 6 yards. Kendrick Bourne, a short carry for 3 yards. Jonnu Smith had a negative one yard rush, so a loss of 1 yard. Mac Jones had a loss of 3 yards on 5 attempts as well. Jonnu Smith, he led the way among the 2 catches total by Patriots receivers. He had 1 catch for 12 yards. Probably one of the bigger portions of the game, though, was after New England had given the momentum to the Bills. The Bills gave it back to New England thanks to a Matt Breida fumble that was recovered by Lawrence Guy. And here's how bad the wind was. That normally
yeah.
you would think a handoff is no problem, right?
Right.
When you're handing off the ball, it should be no problem. But the running back gets it in his hands, and everything's fine and dandy. The wind actually pushed the ball as it was going into Breida's hands. It pushed mm-hmm. the ball through, like as if he had butterfingers or something, and he completely missed the ball.
All right,
and that's when Lawrence Guy of the Patriots then immediately went all over the ball for a fumble recovery. But
I
you know,
can
def- defense was it. Defense was a huge part of this game, though. Matt Judon with another sack, as well as Daniel Ekwale, who they had called up from the practice squad. He had a sack as well. And Nick Folk was a perfect 2 for 2 on field goals, including a 41-yard attempt, which, I mean, for as bad as the wind was, Folk didn't look like he really had many problems on his two lone attempts that he had. Meanwhile, Tyler Bass, he went 1 for 2 on field goals. He did go 1 for 1 on extra points, but he had a field goal of 35 yards, and then he ended up missing. I forget how long it was that he missed, but it was a crucial point in the game, though, when Buffalo could have been down by only 1 point. But that pretty much, after he missed that, that pretty much turned the tide back in New England's favor. And then what I don't get afterwards is, I guess maybe New England must have broken Buffalo again, because all of a sudden, Buffalo's head coach was getting asked, Sean McDermott was getting asked questions about why certain players didn't play. And he said in particular with Isaiah, I'm sure you probably heard of this, Lou. He said players like Isaiah McKenzie, he felt he couldn't trust with handling kickoff returns.
I've heard that.
And it caught the eye of McKenzie, who apparently did not know the reasoning behind it. And, you know, you almost kind of have to wonder with how their coach McDermott reacted following the loss. You kind of have to wonder if maybe he has lost his locker room.
Wow.
Despite a 7-5 record, they're still in the hunt, but for some reason, not only do we see him openly questioning his players, or not putting any confidence in his players, but also the defense, when they were asked a question by a reporter about how embarrassing it must have been to basically be outclassed by Belichick. They ultimately ended up walking out on their press conference. Jordan Poirier and I forget who their other star is. It was Jordan Poirier and Micah Hyde who ended up walking out on their press conference because they were basically asked about their embarrassing run defense. And I kind of found myself asking, as a reporter, why the hell would you focus on something like that? Obviously a team, they just lost a close game. The last thing they're going to want to talk about is something that you call embarrassing.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that, Lou? Should reporters be more mindful about
absolutely
what,
the reporters can really get on the players' nerves and whatnot. They can get a little too personal. They need to have more respect for the players, and be more mindful. I mean, there's because they can really hound you. They're always the first one getting the story, and that's not right.
It's bad enough that Buffalo lost, but the fact that they basically had to get asked stupid questions like that from the media. I mean, first off, there's going to be a lot of people who are probably going to put an asterisk next to this game because of the fact that it was in such poor weather. But in my opinion, if you're a football player or a coach, you need to be prepared to play in any sort of weather.
Of course, that's a risk you take.
That's on McDermott for not straying away from the Bills' regular game plan. I mean, let's face it, that's what the Bills did. They played their regular game plan like as if it was any other football game. They did not take into account what the weather would be, especially in their home stadium.
And you
they
should.
You know, they didn't.
Well, I guess they figured they were used to it.
Yeah, they didn't take into account what the weather would be, you know, what the factors would be in terms of wind and everything. And that's stuff that Belichick does all the time. As a matter of fact, Belichick, you know, there are some teams that maybe they practice indoors or maybe maybe they go through a walkthrough. If there's bad weather that day, maybe they go through a walkthrough instead of doing a full-fledged practice. Belichick has his players out there in the elements in practice, regardless of what the weather is. Belichick had his players prepared. And, I mean, yeah, maybe he could have had Mac Jones throw more than three passes, but it was clearly a game plan by design. Belichick decided, screw this. We are basically going to run the ball down your throats the entire game. And that's essentially what they did. And, you know, granted, maybe, you know, Buffalo, they were missing one of their primary run stoppers. He's still on injured reserve, I think, or dealing with some sort of issue. Star Lotulelei. Originally was thought to be healthy for the Monday night game, but he ultimately ended up missing it as well. But ultimately, you know, when you're dealing with games like that, it's up to the coach to prepare his players.
As it should be.
And the Bills just quite simply were not prepared. I mean, there's not really much more that you can say about that. But I have a feeling McDermott will probably turn things around. Although, considering the Bills face the Tampa Bay Buccaneers this week, Buffalo may find themselves in an even worse spot, with potentially being 7-6 after this week.
Yeah.
Because they currently sit at 7-5, and, I mean, let's face it, they're dealing with Brady. Basically, they went from facing a head coach who has owned them for the last 20 years to now facing a quarterback who has owned them for the last 20 years. So, you know, it's – the Bills, they needed to beat New England in order to have a chance at potentially staying atop the AFC East. And they couldn't get it done. And now they face the possibility of maybe potentially falling that much closer to 500 with a potential loss tomorrow against Tampa Bay.
Yes, I see.
But you know what? Going over to Florida, speaking of Tampa Bay, we're not going to talk about Tampa Bay, though. We are going to talk about Jacksonville, as reportedly there is quite a bit of drama that is forming around the Jacksonville Jaguars, in particular Urban Meyer. According to NFL Network's Tom Pelissero, he's reported that there are questions in league circles about whether Urban Meyer's stay in Jacksonville could potentially end after one season. Jaguar players reportedly vented their frustrations to Rams players after last week's loss, while assistant coaches have been thrown under the bus for Jacksonville's 2-10 season. Now, I'm sorry, when you have your own players venting frustration to the opposing team, that right there
is a horrible sign to begin with.
Yes.
In terms of the state of your franchise. And also, Meyer's public comments that he has made, shifting blame to players and coaches alike, have created a toxic environment in Jacksonville mm-hmm. with multiple heated exchanges between the team and Urban Meyer himself. It was so bad this week that respected veteran and team captain Marvin Jones, who played for an even worse team with the Detroit Lions the past couple of years, he became so upset with Meyer's criticism of the receiver group that he ended up leaving the practice facility until staff members convinced him to come back, while Trevor Lawrence had to question Meyer on the sidelines after his first quarter benching of star running back James Robinson last week. Now, for now, there are no signs that owner Shad Khan is considering firing Meyer, but that could change as Meyer continues to lose the locker room this year. There hasn't been a coach this out of his league with this much backlash in the NFL since Chip Kelly was in Philadelphia. And it's, you know, the article says this, but I'll put it this way, had better success with Philadelphia than Urban Meyer has had with Jacksonville.
Yes.
So, I mean, Chip Kelly was also horrible for San Francisco too, though. But, you know, even though it appears that Urban Meyer is likely headed for a similar fate like Chip Kelly, I think Urban Meyer is now starting to figure. I think Urban Meyer is now starting to find out that you may be able to do this with college players, but you're not going to do this to big men, to grown men in the NFL. And, you know, I think this could be one of those signs. You know, a lot of people said that Urban Meyer, for many years, has been the greatest coach, one of the greatest coaches to never coach in the NFL. I think now we're seeing why. I think now we're seeing why he had never coached in the NFL.
Yes.
Because his stuff works with boys. They don't work with men.
No.
What are your thoughts, Lou, on the dysfunction that we're seeing play out in Jacksonville? I mean, is it almost a foregone conclusion that Urban Meyer should probably be fired by the end of the year?
Hell yeah. He hasn't done, you know, what he thinks he's going to do. You know, college coaches turning into pro doesn't always go well. I mean, not just in football, but in any sport. I've seen it happen. I mean, Cal Perry, he was great in college, but, oh, he's second to pro. So I was thinking that maybe Meyer was going to make the mistake. I knew it wasn't a good idea. I mean, he was a great college coach or anything, but that doesn't always necessarily transfer over to the pros. And he has sure really screwed up that place. Ugh.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who had a career 187-32 record in college. He went 12-3 in bowls, in college bowl appearances. He's a three-time national champion in 2006, 2008, and 2014. A three-time Big Ten champion, two-time champion of the SEC, two-time champion of the Mountain West. You know, he has this huge resume in college, but yet you bring him over to the NFL, and
he's a bust.
He's a complete bust. I mean, this isn't the first time that he's been that he's had news written about him this year, as he was publicly reprimanded earlier this year by owner Shad Khan following the social media videos, I'm pretty sure you remember, that happened at his Columbus area restaurant, where he was seen with a young woman who is not his wife, and he appeared to grope the woman as she was kind of giving him a lap dance, I guess.
Yeah.
And I mean, you kind of have to wonder, you know, how many instances do you need as a team before you realize that this isn't, you know, this isn't the guy to go with.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he had a great college career, but it's just not the same. It's just not the same coaching in the big leagues as opposed to coaching in college.
Not at all.
I mean, hell, those you know, those days of coaching at Ohio State or coaching at Florida are long gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's a much different game coaching in the big leagues. So I would be stunned if he remains as the head coach of Jacksonville, considering all the problems that are starting to rise up.
Yeah.
And kind of figures, staying on the coaching carousel here, the Panthers, they before their game or before the games started last week, I believe they were on their bye week last week, I think. But the Panthers, they fired offensive coordinator Joe Brady after he was hired to be Matt Rhule's offensive coordinator ahead of the 2020 season, after Brady had coordinated LSU to a national title on the backs of Joe Burrow and Justin Jefferson that year.
Right.
And he was, this is a guy that was so up and coming as a potential head coach that last off season, he interviewed for several head coaching jobs. Now, obviously he didn't get any of them. But Brady was definitely being viewed as a future head coach. Now, after just over 1.5 seasons on the job, he is out of Carolina. So, I mean, it is possible that maybe perhaps now he'll be headed back to the college ranks to sort of
recover. That'd be a smart thing to do.
It would be, yes. Especially considering, he does have, you know, a resume of success at the college level with what he was able to do with LSU. I mean, at this point, if you can't make it as a coordinator in the NFL, how the hell would you make it as a head coach in the NFL? So
you can't.
Exactly. So now assistant Jeff Nixon will work alongside Matt Rhule in coordinating the offense for the rest of the year. As a result of this, Trenton Cannon, this was a pretty scary sight that happened last week with the 49ers against the Seattle Seahawks. Trenton Cannon had to be taken off of the field in an ambulance after he was basically bent backwards in a apparent neck injury. He suffered it on the off. Seattle safety Talanoa Hufanga's knee had collided with Cannon's neck on the play. And the good news is he was able to wave to the crowd as he left, as he was carried over to the ambulance. But it's pretty bad when you have to bring, you know, you can't even get stretchered off of the field. They needed to bring in the ambulance with lights and all to get him off the field.
Right.
I mean, that's got to be pretty bad. Unless they were just taking extra special precautions and they didn't want to risk. They didn't want to risk something with the stretcher. I don't know, but
right.
It was a pretty nasty fall that he took, with him basically being bent backwards, essentially.
Yes.
And speaking of injuries, Randall Cobb, he has reportedly been sidelined several games after undergoing core muscle surgery. So Aaron Rodgers will be without one of his favorite wide receivers for the foreseeable future. This basically elevates Marquez Valdez-Scantling and Alan Lazard into a much bigger snap load for Sunday Night Football this week against the Bears. And he's been an admirable underneath receiver for the Packers after they had reacquired him in a trade with the Texans. But he will if he's sidelined for the rest of the season, he will finish with 28 catches for 375 yards and 5 touchdowns. However, he does have a $9.6 million cap hit. So this may be almost certain to make him a target for restructure or maybe possibly even a release for the end of the season, after the end of the season here.
Mm-hmm.
So Lou, you got to think that with him being one of the key portions of that Green Bay offense, that this could potentially have an effect on the rest of the season as a whole for the Packers.
About
5 games or so remaining, I believe.
Something like that, yes.
I mean, obviously, you know, the Vikings, you know, they're 6-7, so the Packers are sitting kind of nice and pretty in the NFC North, so they don't really have to worry about, you know, losing the division. But when it comes to the longer, the bigger picture, the playoff race, if Cobb is out for the playoffs, possibly, I mean, that could have a pretty big effect on what happens in potentially Aaron Rodgers' final year with the Green Bay Packers.
Right.
And especially considering Randall Cobb was one of the main reasons why, Rodgers agreed to come back. He said, I will come back if you do a couple of things. And one of the things is you bring Randall Cobb back to Green Bay, which they did. So, I mean, Lou, what are your thoughts? You know, how big of a loss could this potentially be for the Packers in the long term?
Well, this could be a devastating loss. I mean, they're hanging in there. I mean, Rodgers has problems, you know, all the field management, but, you know, if anything were to go wrong, this is going to cost the Packers, you know, pretty deeply.
I mean, when you're trying to stay pace to pace with the Buccaneers and the Cardinals for the top two seeds in the NFC, you know, it's pretty devastating to lose a key receiver like Randall Cobb at this point in time. You know, I mean, he is putting up pretty big numbers to have 5 touchdowns. You know, he's clearly one of Aaron Rodgers' favorite targets.
Yeah.
And the problem has just been, even though he has 22 catches, you know, the problem has just been that, you know, Cobb hasn't been able to reel in some of the targets that he's had. Speaking of wide receivers, unfortunately, we have to talk about Demaryius Thomas, who unexpectedly passed away earlier this week at the age of 33. Demaryius Thomas was a Super Bowl champion with the Denver Broncos back when Peyton Manning played in his final season. Actually, I believe it was his 5th season for Demaryius Thomas in a Denver Broncos uniform. He was in the prime of his career at that time. Actually, you know, his best seasons were with the Broncos, as after that, you know, he went to Houston, didn't do anything, went to New England, he didn't even I believe with New England, he didn't even make the cut. And New York, he played one season in New York, 11 games, only had a touchdown. It seems like after he left Denver, basically a shell of what his former self was, in terms of the player. But, you know, he is by far probably one of the best Denver Broncos of all time, putting up 60 touchdown catches in Broncos history. There have been calls, actually, by multiple players for the Broncos to retire his number 88 jersey following this news. And, you know, not just that, but he was also a postseason performer, too. He had 6 career touchdowns in the first 4 years that he was in the playoffs. 6 touchdowns. Then obviously the next, what's kind of surprising is he didn't have any touchdown catches at all during the championship year in 2015. And he would have played. He would have played in 2018 had he not been injured when Houston made the playoffs in 2018. But still, it says here that this isn't the first time that he had medical issues. His death was attributed to a medical issue. And he had reportedly experienced health problems back in 2019 after he suffered a car crash, or after he was involved in a car crash, I should say.
Right.
And police had claimed that his death was attributed to a medical issue. You know, he was found in the shower, supposedly.
Yes.
And in the documents that were submitted by the police, they initially responded to his residence out in Georgia after they had received a call in reference to a cardiac arrest. Dispatch had reportedly advised them that the victim was not conscious and not breathing. When officers arrived, they said in the docs that they had to push a gate open with their hands in order to even gain entry into the home. Once inside, they found him laying down in the shower on his back with clear signs of rigor mortis visible. He was officially pronounced dead on the scene, and the autopsy was performed yesterday, I believe, or it was scheduled to be performed yesterday. I don't know if they officially did it. But he called it quits back in June after spending 11 years in the league. He was the number 22 overall pick of the 2010 draft by head coach Josh McDaniels at the time with the Denver Broncos. His career did get off to a slow start under Kyle Orton and Tim Tebow, but following Peyton Manning's arrival, he basically went supernova and stacked up an astounding 5,787 receiving yards during Manning's 4 years with the team, never posting fewer than 1,304 per season. Mm-hmm. And he did clear 1,000 again back in 2016. Despite those glory days with Manning, though, his signature play came with Tebow at the helm, when he walked off the Steelers in the 2011-2012 wild card round with an 80-yard touchdown grab in overtime, which, you know, NFL fans would know that's on many highlight reels when it comes to playoff football.
Yeah.
A 5-time Pro Bowler and a 2-time second team All-Pro, Demaryius Thomas was considered to be one of the best receivers of the decade in a golden age for the wide receiver position. So, what are your thoughts, Lou, on Demaryius Thomas as a player overall? Do you think we're looking at a Hall of Fame credential resume here? I mean, it's it's
bad to say.
He's considering
he's great for Denver. Yeah, I think he's seen him as a Hall of Famer.
It's bad to say considering he passed away. It's bad to say it that way.
Yes,
but you know, considering his numbers, when you take a look at his numbers overall, I mean, a career, he was only 300 passing or 300 receiving yards away from 10,000. He had an average of 13.5 yards per catch. His longest was an 86-yard touchdown. 63 touchdowns total in his NFL career. To me, when you compare that with, or not compare it, but when you combine that with his other accomplishments, he is a Super Bowl champion, a four-time Pro Bowler, a two-time second-team All-Pro. I think it's I don't know if it's first ballot status, but I think he's definitely a Hall of Famer. I think, you know, even with it being posthumously, I think if anybody's thinking of whether or not he's Hall of Fame material or not, I think it's very, very wrong of me to say it this way, but especially because he has now passed away, I don't know what it is, but it seems like people sort of have more of a soft spot when a player has passed away. That all of a sudden they're like, oh well, maybe he should get in now. Like it's almost like if say Roger Clemens. I'm gonna make a very bad comparison here, but let's just say Roger Clemens mysteriously passes away before the Hall of Fame numbers are revealed.
Right.
For this year, it's almost as if, you know, maybe perhaps they would say, okay, you know, maybe he should get in this year. You know, the fact that he's, despite the fact that he missed, you know, all of the previous years, maybe he can get it. Maybe we should put him in this year.
Yes.
And by the way, speaking of which, we do have an updated ballot total. We have had five new ballots for the Baseball Hall of Fame since last week. Some updated totals through 14 ballots. Barry Bonds is on 10 of them. Roger Clemens is on 10 of them. Todd Helton is on 8 of them.
He'll never get in.
You still think he'll never get in?
No.
Well, I mean, it kind of makes sense. The steroid scandal does have a huge thing behind it. So it would make sense. But, you know, as far as the updated numbers, you know, some of the really big names in this list, especially those who are on their final year of eligibility, Sosa, he only has four votes. He's not going to get in at this pace. Curt Schilling, he has 8 votes.
That's a long shot for him.
It's a long shot, yeah, kind of. Todd Helton, he still has 6 years after this year, so it's not a big deal if Helton doesn't make it in this year. He has the same amount, eight votes out of 14 ballots. But as far as the big names, Bonds and Clemens, they're on their final years. They are currently on 10 of the 14 ballots. Todd Helton on 8. Let's see. David Ortiz is on 8 of them as well. Alex Rodriguez is on 6 of them. So he's trending in the wrong direction right now. And he probably won't get in, especially considering his the fact that he – I mean, it's one thing for David Ortiz to, you know, pop up as positive, but they never confirmed what he tested positive for and whether it was banned. It's one thing to pop up for that, but in A-Rod's case, he pretty much popped up for almost everything.
Yeah.
So it's I wouldn't say it's a good sign at all for A-Rod. But
no.
As far
when he signed that mega deal and only put in 3 years of a 10-year deal, that's it right there. And then the story broke out because of the Yankees, and that was the end of that.
Yeah. But, you know, I will say, even though we're talking about the fact that Bonds and Clemens probably won't make it in, right now they are on a pretty good track. They are currently on 71.4% of the ballots, which is actually higher than their final percentage from last year. So, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll be surprised, but it's obviously,
I think when the committee's done its ways, I highly doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, it also doesn't help either that one person sent in a zero vote ballot. Let me check. Has there been another one that has sent in?
Zero.
Nope, just one ballot that has been sent in completely blank. And the let's see, how many total are there actually? So only 3.6% of the ballots have been made available. So, you know, there's still plenty of opportunity for other names to start to rise here. Some of the names that have not received any votes as of yet: Tim Hudson, Torrey Hunter, Tim Lincecum, Mark Burley, Joe Nathan, Jonathan Papelbon, and Mark Teixeira have all received no votes so far.
Even Teixeira, pineapple.
Which is a bad sign, because don't you need, I believe you need what? Like
75%.
5%? I know you need 75%, but how much do you need? You need what, 5% to remain on the ballot, I think?
Oh, that, yeah. Yes, 5% to remain on the ballot.
So it's a pretty bad sign if you're, I mean, granted, it's very early, only 3% in, but it's a pretty bad sign if the first 14 ballots are in and you're not on either of those 14 ballots.
Yeah.
I mean, I am kind of surprised at some of the names that, I mean, hell, even Jimmy Rollins has only been on one of the 14 ballots that have already been submitted.
There's another list, though, that people have been neglecting, because there were six new members that got in, the old-timers, well, I shouldn't say old-timers, but there were a few in this other Hall of Fame, and Jim Cott got in as about time. 83 years old, he was a good player. He also was a Yankee broadcaster.
Oh, okay, yeah. So those are more of the legacy inductees,
yes.
Right?
Right.
Okay, yeah. That kind of makes sense then. Yeah, you know, it's kind of like what they said of Schilling you know, that if he doesn't get in, he would probably get in with the Legacy Hall of Fame, and so would, you know, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds and whatnot. Of course, that would be, you know, years down the line, you know.
Yeah, but
so
they'll never forget the bloody sock. What a shame.
No, I mean, the bloody sock is in the Hall of Fame, actually.
I know.
If you go to the Hall
of
Fame, yeah, but you know, if you go to the Hall of Fame, you know, you have the bloody sock in there. So, it's,
yuck.
You know, I'm kind of surprised, honestly, that I was surprised that he missed it last year. I thought he was going to get it last year.
You know, I think you're right
about
that. I think I'm surprised that too.
I thought out of everybody that missed, I mean, Clemens, Bonds, Schilling, I thought I was most surprised by Schilling because I thought Schilling had at least a little bit of a chance to get in before the inevitable 10th ballot. So I was kind of surprised at that one.
Right.
Let's see. We do have some news from the NHL. A huge turn of events for the Dallas Stars. Ben Bishop, their star goaltender, will not be able to return from his knee injury, as he missed the entire campaign last year and was working to return this season. However, it has now been confirmed by the general manager that his playing career will officially come to an end at the age of 35.
Wow.
And his final attempt to return was when he played for the AHL Texas Stars this past Thursday, where he surrendered 8 goals on 34 shots. And Jim Nill said, it's no secret he has a degenerative knee injury, and he went down there. He wanted to be a big part of this. He wanted to do everything he could to get back. In the end, by going through the process, going down there and playing, he found out that it's the end of his career. And it's a terrible, terrible way for Bishop to end his career, considering the numbers that he put up. A career record of 222 wins, 128 losses, and 36 overtime losses. He posted a 2.32 goals against average and a 92.1 save percentage in 413 career NHL games. I may be one of the biggest shockers in terms of retirement, considering the fact that Ben Bishop, you know, for many years, he was considered to be one of the top goaltenders in the league ever since he came into the league, actually. You know, he started off originally with the St. Louis Blues, never really got a shot there. Then he ultimately ended up being sent over to Ottawa. And that's where he started to get opportunities as a backup goaltender before he got traded over to the Tampa Bay Lightning, and his career pretty much took off once he hit Tampa.
Right.
I mean, he had his first year of actually starting, he had a 37-14-7 record, followed by a 40-13-5 record, 35-21-4, and then in his final season in Tampa, he had a 16-12-3 record before he was ultimately shipped off to L.A. And then he had a couple of good years for the Stars, the last 3 years of his career, essentially, 26-17-5, 27-15-2, and 21-16-4. For the Dallas Stars. I mean, clearly the numbers are worse because he doesn't have as much talent in Dallas as he had with Tampa. in front of him. But also in the playoffs, he had a career playoff record of 29-21 with, through 52 playoff games with a career goals against average of 2.27 and a 92.4 save percentage in the playoffs.
Okay.
So he actually had a better playoff record, not in terms of wins and losses, but in terms of goals against average and save percentage compared to his, you know, his regular season career. But he was a one-time All-Star back in 2016. He made the All-Star team, or he made the second All-Star team, I should say, 2 years as well, 2016 and 2019. But, it's a shame. You know, he was probably one of the better goaltenders in recent years, and he's actually the tallest goaltender to ever play in the NHL. Standing at a tall 6'7". You know, normally you don't see goaltenders that big.
No.
And he was also a 3-time Vezina Trophy finalist, though a lot of people believe that he actually should have won the Vezina one of those years. Let me see. What year was it? It was the 2014-2015 season that I believe that one ended up going to. I want to say it was Tuukka that beat him out, but let me see. Vezina Trophy. No, it was Carey Price that beat him out there. You know what, Carey Price, that's another one we might see retire, depending on where he is with his with his mental health situation. He might actually end up retiring soon.
Again, with the mental health.
It is really strange, considering, you know, considering everything, where the current state of you know, the world in general, where mental health is now becoming a much bigger issue every year. Here we go. I was trying to remember what I wanted to talk about, and now I finally figured it out. Ben Simmons. We do have some news about Ben Simmons. As apparently there has been a whole bunch of movement in recent days around the trade talks for Ben Simmons, who still hasn't played a game this season for the 76ers. Portland, they are involved in trade talks. However, Damian Lillard is not considered to be a part of those trade talks. So for any Sixers fans who are hoping to land Ben Simmons or hoping to trade Ben Simmons for Damian Lillard, you can stop. It ain't happening. If you're going to trade Simmons to Portland, it's going to be for somebody else. More likely CJ McCollum, maybe. That would probably be the more likely scenario of what you would get in return. Let's see, the Boston Celtics, they reportedly have been involved. Jaylen Brown's name has come up in talks involving a Ben Simmons trade. There's been other teams, I think they said as much as 5 or 6 different teams, I think, that have been in contact with Philadelphia trying to make multiple team deals, you know, either 2-team or 3-team deals. There's been multiple scenarios that have been discussed in recent days. However, the Sixers, they still want a top-tier talent. They want at least a top 25 player for Ben Simmons in return.
Sure.
And when you think about it, it is kind of astronomical, but I mean, you can kind of see why Philadelphia would want that much in return, considering the potential that Ben Simmons has as a player. I mean, you know, it's just like what was it Charles Barkley or was it Kenny Smith who said it? I forget who it was, but one of them said he has all of the talents to be basically the next to LeBron James at point guard. The only
I think Kenny Smith said
thing.
That.
Okay, so it probably was Kenny Smith. I knew it was one of the two. It was either Barkley or Kenny Smith. But the big thing that is holding him back is the fact that he is afraid to make shots at will. He is afraid to basically fail, essentially.
Well, you can't blame him for that.
But yet, you know, you take a look at his career stats through 275 games. He's averaging close to 16 points per game, 7.7 assists per game, and 8.1 rebounds. I mean, and he's also averaging 1.7 steals per game as well. He's a career 56% shooter from the field. His 3-point percentage could be better. You know, he's gotten a lot better in recent years from the 3-point line, and free throws could be better as well. But, you know, he's primarily a playmaker. So
right.
You would want to stick him on a team. Like, I'll choose Boston, for example. Boston, I believe, could actually benefit from acquiring Ben Simmons because they have two guys right now, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, who are basically both trying to be the guy. And let's face it, you're not gonna be able to have both players coexist and be the guy. You know, it's kind of like with LeBron James and Dwayne Wade. You know, Dwayne Wade, he decided to take a back seat once LeBron came in to Miami. You know, originally before LeBron came in, Miami was Dwayne Wade's team. Once LeBron came in, it became LeBron's team. You gotta be able to have two guys where one guy is willing to take a backseat to the other, and you're just not seeing that right now in Boston between Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum.
No.
So I think with this proposal that's being floated around out there, that would include Jaylen Brown in a trade for Ben Simmons. I mean, obviously, maybe perhaps there would be other players mixed in on both sides, but I think it could potentially be beneficial for Boston, even though they'd be missing or they'd be losing the huge output that Jaylen Brown brings in each of his games. They would also be getting the playmaker that they have been missing since Rajon Rondo was in his prime. You know, so I think, I mean, Jaylen Brown, he had a career year last year, 24.7 points per game, 3.4 assists, 6 rebounds per game. He had career years in field goal percentage, 3-point percentage, and free throw percentage, as well as minutes per game as well. So the numbers are there, you know, for anybody, if you're looking for somebody in return for Ben Simmons, this would be the guy that Philadelphia would want to go after. And this year, you know, he's averaging 21.4 points per game, 5.2 rebounds, and 2.2 assists. But ever since COVID, ever since he came down with COVID, he's been having problems staying healthy. I mean, COVID took him out for a certain amount of time, and then he's been dealing with a hamstring issue recently. So I don't know if maybe that might have some sort of, effect on whether or not he gets traded. But, you know, regardless, this is, you know, that's one of the trade scenarios that's being floated around out there for Ben Simmons. So what are your thoughts, Lou? Do you ultimately, do they ultimately somehow convince Ben Simmons to return to playing for Philly? Or do you think maybe a Philadelphia trade may happen sooner rather than later with all this momentum being built up?
I'm going to take the second option, trade him later.
So right now, I mean, you know, but when you look at Boston, they're 13-14 right now. Clearly, you know, this is a season they got a new coach. They got this was the season that the team is supposed to be built around Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. The question kind of now becomes, okay, is this a case of these two not being able to work well together, or is this a case of Boston just doesn't have any players around them?
I always think Boston has really good players around.
Because you would think that with two stars like Tatum and Brown, that they would be in a much better position where they compared to where they are now.
Especially by now.
By the way, I saw how the Knicks have been on quite the slide recently. 3-7 in their last 10.
Not good.
What the hell has happened out there in New York?
Well, you know, it could be anything. It could be the manager's too cheap to get good players, which I've heard. You know, the coaching is slacked off. So it could be any number of things.
Too cheap. They got Evan Fournier.
Yeah, I know.
Who was probably one of the top free agents this year. I mean, yeah, he's underperforming this year, but he, you know, heading out of last year and considering what he did in the Olympics, you know, he was one of the top performers point wise. So, you know, I don't know what's going on actually with
it's been
with New York.
They started
right
out
now.
So well, and then, you know, things just started to unravel.
And actually, you take a look at the Eastern Conference itself. I mean, Brooklyn, they're back on top. Milwaukee, they have seemingly surged. They have surged back towards the top. At one point, they were in the play-in tournament, and now they're in the second seed. And the only reason they're in the second seed ahead of Chicago, who has the same record as them, is because of the Greek Freak, but the conference record. Milwaukee has a better conference record compared to Chicago.
But the Greek Freak is playing a big part in their success.
Oh, yeah, obviously. Miami, they're in the number 4 spot. Cleveland, surprisingly, is in the number 5 spot. They are sticking around despite losing a majority of their stars this year. With Colin Sexton being out for the year, that's forcing Darius Garland into a much larger role compared to where he was being dead at the first part. And hell, you know, they're considered to have one of the top rookies in the league in Evan Mobley. You know, he's firmly in the rookie of the year the rookie of the year talks right now, averaging 14 points per game, 8.5 rebounds, and 2.5 assists. you know, they have a very young nucleus right now that they're building around. And obviously once Lauri Markkanen officially gets back to full health, you know, we're going to start to see him start to perform again. I mean, right now you could be potentially looking at Cleveland as a sleeper team potentially to make the playoffs.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And it's kind of surprising considering, you know, such a young club. I mean, yeah, they got Kevin Love and they got Ricky Rubio as – well, they also have Ed Davis as their top three mm-hmm. veterans on the club.
Right.
But other than that, you know, there's a lot of young players here. And, you know, for the most part, we're seeing this team pretty much stick around for as long as they possibly can.
Right.
But we got Philadelphia. They are in the number six spot. In the play-in tournament, we currently have the Washington Wizards, the Charlotte Hornets, the Atlanta Hawks, and the Boston Celtics just barely hanging in there with Toronto and New York on the outside looking in as of now.
Yeah. Well, it's still a long way to go, though.
Oh, yeah, still plenty of time left. I mean, we're only a quarter of the way through the season, so... still plenty of time to go. We have a dogfight, though, in the Western Conference for the top spot. You got Phoenix and Golden State trading blows one after the other. Phoenix is atop the conference right now at 21-4, following a complete blowout of the Boston Celtics last. And Golden State is currently in the second spot at 21-5. And keep in mind, this is all without Klay Thompson. And with him now officially playing for the G League Warrior team, once he gets back to full health, wait until you see what they're able to do with a healthy Klay Thompson, adding him
yeah.
to this already stacked lineup.
I've been saying that.
I would probably put, even though as good as Phoenix is right now, I would probably be looking at Golden State as the favorite to hoist the Larry O'Brien trophy this
Despite
year.
Despite tonight's loss?
Despite tonight's loss, yes. I would still see Golden State as the favorite. Utah, you know, they're not that far behind, 19-7. Then it kind of drops off from there. You got Memphis in the fourth spot at 16-11, and they ended up winning tonight despite not having Ja Morant or Jaren Jackson Jr. either. They're two top stars out of action, and yet Memphis somehow ended up winning. Then you got the two L.A. teams, the Clippers and the Lakers, side by side at number 5 and 6. You got Denver at 7. You have Dallas at 8. You have Portland at 9 and Minnesota at 10. It's bad when your last two potential playoff teams have an 11-15 record so far. I mean, it's almost like the Western Conference and Eastern Conference
yep.
have switched sides again. It seemed like for the last few years, you had the Eastern Conference who had some high level teams, like numbers, maybe seeds 1 through 4 were highly competitive. And then you had 5 through 10 would be absolutely, you know, hard to look at, basically. And instead, we have that here with the Western Conference, while the Eastern Conference is a lot closer compared to, you know, in between each team from number one all the way down to number 10.
Yes.
Compared to some of the numbers that we're seeing in the Western Conference right now.
You know, it looked for a while in the beginning of the season the Eastern Conference was shaping up and maybe overtaking the West, but now it's gone back to reverse and it is now going back into the Western Conference favor.
Yeah, but, you know, obviously, you know, it is a long season, but I will say I still believe that the NBA champion will probably come out of the Western Conference this year. I would be surprised. Number one, I would be surprised if Milwaukee repeats. I would also be surprised if an Eastern Conference team took the win this year.
Yeah.
So I think we're still probably looking at Western Conference led NBA championship. Speaking of the NBA, Jeremy Grant, Pistons forward Jeremy Grant, he suffered torn ligaments in his right thumb, and he will be out indefinitely. So as if the lowly Pistons could get any lower, they just lost their leading scorer, and now it appears he will be out for quite some time after averaging 20.1 points per game this year, along with landing 1.8 three-pointers per game to go with 1.1 steals and 1.1 blocks per game. So essentially, Detroit, who's already at the bottom of the league at 4-21, them losing their number one player, it pretty much you can basically eliminate them from any sort of playoff contention whatsoever at this point. You know, their season effectively is done today.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that just came over the wire at this point here. Let's see. There are a couple of players who have already been ruled out for the NFL. The 49ers, they will be without Dante Johnson. They're one of their cornerbacks. He has been listed as out for tomorrow's game against the Bengals due to personal reasons. They will also be without Emmanuel Mosley due to an ankle injury as he was placed on injured reserve. So it looks like if anybody owns Joe Burrow in fantasy, this is probably the game that you're going to want to start him. And wow, the Bruins are just piling on the Flames right now, 3-0 in what seems like it's turning into a game of the defense. As so far, two of their three goals have been by defensemen so far tonight, with Connor Clifton and Charlie McAvoy just now. The other goal, of course, being Brad Marchand. This is interesting. So Derwin James, apparently he must have suffered a hamstring injury or something either during or after yesterday's practice, because he has now all of a sudden been listed as questionable due to the hamstring injury by the Chargers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, late-week injuries usually lead to a player being inactive, but it is kind of promising that he was listed as questionable. And, you know, considering he's coming off of a couple of injury-marred seasons, he has played almost every snap this season. So if they were to lose Derwin James, depending on the severity of the injury, that could be a pretty huge loss for the Chargers.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Chargers, they placed cornerback Chris Harris on the reserve COVID list as a close contact. No, he was activated from the COVID list. Okay, so he will be active for tomorrow's game. So he will be active for tomorrow's game. Trayvon Mullen, he has been activated from injured reserve for the Vegas Raiders, so he is good to go for tomorrow's matchup. Bryce Callahan, he was also activated from injured reserve for the Broncos, so he has officially recovered from his knee injury. He is likely good to go for tomorrow. Randy
yes.
Gregory has been activated by the Cowboys off of injured reserve due to a calf injury, so he is good to go. The Bills, they have activated John Feliciano from injured reserve with his calf issue. They probably wish that he was able to go against New England last week. The Atlanta Falcons, they activated Hayden Hurst off of injured reserve with his ankle injury. So he is healthy enough to suit up against the Panthers tomorrow. Oh, this is actually a big one. Elijah Moore, well,
ooh.
I mean, not really big. Not really big because, I mean, it's big for the Jets, but the Jets aren't really in a playoff spot or in any position to contend for the playoffs. But it is a pretty big loss for the rookie. Elijah Moore was placed on injured reserve with a quad issue. So they're already without Corey Davis for the rest of the year. So you're probably looking at Keelan Cole, Denzel Mims, and Jamison Crowder as your top three receivers for the Jets moving forward. And it looks like the Cardinals will wait until Monday to decide if Chase Edmonds will be activated from injured reserve from his ankle injury. They have until 4 p.m. Monday to make the move. So we'll see if he gets activated or if James Conner will probably receive all of the carries once again. The Chargers, they did also activate Mike Williams from the COVID-19 list after Keenan Allen was sidelined due to COVID. So they will at least have one of their receivers back, as Williams was considered to be a close contact more than a actual, you know, somebody actually with COVID. Darrell Henderson of the L.A. Rams, he has been placed on the reserve COVID-19 list after he had appeared to be on track to return from his quad injury. However, he then came down with COVID, or maybe he was a close contact. I don't know. Sony Michel will once again be the workhorse for the L.A. Rams this week, with Henderson officially being out. Also being placed on the COVID list was Salvin Ahmed from the Miami Dolphins, along with Miles Gaskin. So Philip Lindsay is the only healthy running back on Miami's roster right now.
The good news is
that Miami is on their bye. However, it is possible that both Ahmed and Gaskin may not get cleared to play next week. Lou, what the hell is going on here with COVID? You know, it's
That's what I was saying earlier.
A lot of people. Obviously, there are some people who are anti-vaccine. Anti-vaccination. We've seen all the sports leagues start putting strict guidelines in play when it comes to COVID. And, you know, it just seems like with this new variant being brought around here, you kind of have to wonder almost if we may reach a point where we may see sports start to shut down again with how big of an issue
it's going
this
to happen.
New variant.
It is going to happen.
With how, all right, what are your thoughts, Lou?
It is going to happen. I mean, you know, the numbers are going up, and I think that within the next month or two, I think you will see the league shut down again. And baseball's already shut down, so that's the problem right there. You know, they're not even speaking, but you know, this is only going to make it worse.
I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a case of who's vaccinated and who's not vaccinated, because
no.
You know, most players are vaccinated. The problem is that we may see so many cases that it could put potential games in jeopardy of even being played if there aren't enough players available.
Right.
For certain teams.
Right, because look at the Bulls. I mean, they have five on the list.
Yeah.
It's been a complete outbreak on the team right there.
And, you know, there have been so many players in the NBA also, you know, not just the Bulls, that have been unable to play because of having to deal with COVID. You know, you had Jaylen Brown earlier this year. He came down with COVID. You know, the different members of the Bulls roster have been struck with it. You know, and it's not just basketball. There's also hockey. There's football. So many players have either come down with it or they've been considered close contacts and thus have to – well, actually, no, never mind, because if it's – I forgot. If a player is vaccinated, they need to produce at least two negative tests.
You know, 24 hours apart.
Yeah, 24 hours apart before they can officially return to practice and playing. So, you know, it just seems, and from what it sounds like this new Omicron variant, which has now found its way into the States, supposedly it is more transmissible than the original COVID virus. So,
yeah,
you know, who knows how many more cases we could potentially see pop up here when it comes to dealing with COVID-19 overall. I mean, it is entirely possible that it may become less of a case of who's vaccinated and who's not vaccinated, and more of a case of, will we even have enough players to, you know, to actually be able, because they only allow, like for the NBA, for the NFL, for example, you almost have to wonder if eventually they'll just, they'll get rid of that rule where they can only bring up, they can only elevate a certain amount of players from the practice squad each week.
Right.
And in particular, they can only elevate them a certain amount of times. Like, I think it's only two or three times that a player can be elevated before they have to either be permanently put on the active roster, or they have to go through waivers.
Yes.
So I almost wonder if maybe the NFL may eventually do something where it'll be like, okay, you can basically, you can send people through your practice squad, from the practice squad to the main roster and so on and so forth as many times as you want during a season without there being any sort of ramifications because of the fact that COVID is becoming such a huge problem now. I mean, it already is a huge problem, but, you know, in terms of transmission, I mean, at some point, you have to think there's going to be a need to be able to have players that can immediately be called upon instead of having to sign a player off of free agency or whatnot, and then expect them to be ready for game action that very same week. I mean, they could still have it to where, okay, you can call a player up to the main roster as many times as you want and send them back down as many times as you want, but they could still allow it so that players could still be signed by other teams off of other teams' practice rosters, you know, so that part wouldn't be taken away. But, you know, assuming that we're going to have to deal with COVID for the foreseeable future here, you know, there's going to have to be some sort of exception that's going to have to be made if teams may have to continuously promote players from the you know, the practice squad. There is one big name returning from injured reserve this week, and that is Julio Jones with a wide receiver exhausted team with the Tennessee Titans, who will be without A.J. Brown for at least another two games due to his chest injury. The good news is Julio Jones is officially returning to game action tomorrow against the Jacksonville Jaguars after being on injured reserve the last 3 weeks with his hamstring issue. So against the Jaguars secondary, that's been among the league's worst, allowing a 71% completion rate to opposing quarterbacks this year, you could potentially see Julio Jones have a potential big game. You may see the Atlanta Falcon Julio Jones be back this week. The Browns, they have also activated linebacker Jacob Phillips from injured reserve with his arm issue. So he will make his season debut after missing 7 games as a rookie, and he spent the first 13 weeks this year on injured reserve with an arm injury. So with Anthony Walker, their starting linebacker, being sidelined due to COVID, Phillips will step in, but he is not expected, though, to see a full workload in his first game back. Also ruled out for this week, the Browns will be without tight end David Njoku, who is on the COVID list. So he has been ruled as out. Harrison Bryant has been ruled as out with an ankle injury. Greg Newsome, he is out with a concussion, so the Browns will be without him after he got injured on the final play of practice yesterday. So he is in concussion protocol. I mean, there's, you know, you're seeing a lot of, you know, a lot of players down this week in particular.
Yeah.
But let me take a look, actually. Let me go find Adam Schefter and see, because he does. Oh, actually, in particular, here we go. The Lions, they actually face. Oh, you know what? That's another thing. The Lions, they actually won a football game this week.
Exactly. Wonders never cease, does it?
Nope, it's amazing that, you know, it looked like they were about to blow yet another game against this time against Minnesota, but Detroit, they ended up hanging on and winning it. Now they reportedly have placed 6 players on the COVID-19 list this past week and also had 12 additional players and 6 coaches who battled the flu. So they may be heading into tomorrow's game against the Broncos with a roster shortage. Which leads to my previous thing, that if you have a case like this, they should be able to call up players from their practice squad as many times as they want.
I think they should.
There's a reason why there's
I guess maybe after they won, they went over celebrating and got out of hand.
Maybe. But you know, there's a reason why there's developmental. Like for example, baseball, hockey, basketball, there's a reason why there's developmental teams.
Right.
It's in case there's players that go down with injury, you need somebody to come up in their place. That's what developmental rosters are kind of for. And the NFL is literally the only league that doesn't have that, with the exception of, okay, they kind of have it with a practice squad, but there's a limit to how many times a practice squad player can get called up.
Right.
They're literally the only league around that has that problem. All right, players who are expected to be out tomorrow, according to Adam Schefter, they include Elijah Mitchell, Jamal Adams, who is dealing with an injury of his own. I think he may be out for the rest of the year, I think. Travis Homer, Darren Waller, he will miss another game for the Raiders, so that's a big loss for their offense. Calvin Ridley, he is still out for the Falcons. Michael Carter is out for the Jets, I think. Tevin Coleman is also out, along with Greg Newsome, Harrison Bryant, David Njoku, Antonio Brown. Keenan Allen is out. Daniel Jones is out, which means that Mike Glennon will be the starter for the Giants.
That's a good choice.
Kadarius Toney is still out as well. DeAndre Swift is out. Jamal Williams is out, and Randall Cobb, obviously, with his surgery that he underwent. Expected to play tomorrow include Joe Burrow with that nasty pinky injury. I don't know if you saw that, Lou, but it looked like his pinky was bent in another direction.
Whoa.
Yet, I mean, he had problems like, I shouldn't say it was bent in another direction, but, you know, it looked like he would have problems throwing because it was on his throwing hand.
Yeah.
And
he
visibly grimaced when they showed him throw after suffering the injury, and he was, the defense was out there. They showed him attempting to make warm-up tosses, and he grimaced with each throw, like very visible grimaces.
Yeah.
With each throw that he attempted. I mean, it was bad. But apparently he is going to play through it for the rest of the season, from what it sounds like. Joe Mixon, he will also be active for the Bengals. Taysom Hill and Alvin Kamara are expected to be back for the Saints. That's good news for New Orleans. Bad news for the Jets, obviously, who face them. Jeff Wilson will return after a lengthy absence from the 49ers, so maybe perhaps that running game will start to pick up pace for San Francisco, who desperately needs it as they're trying to hang on to a playoff spot. Mike Glennon, as I said, he's expected to play as the starter for the Giants. Mike Williams, he is expected to be active after being activated from the COVID list. Richard Sherman, he is expected to be activated from injured reserve, and he will play for the Buccaneers. And David Montgomery is expected to play as well for the Chicago Bears. So needless to say, Lou, there's been a handful or more than a handful of injuries that have really, really plagued the league this year.
Well, injuries are nothing new. I mean, that's as old as the league itself. I mean, we expect that. You're not going to get hurt anyway. That's the risk you take.
Yeah. I mean, obviously. Obviously, you know, you kind of expect it, but it sort of seems like we've seen more injuries this year than normal.
Last year, too.
Yeah, it was. Needless to say, it's been quite a few, quite a few disastrous years when it comes to injuries.
Well, last year you had to blame that because nobody even practiced, and that was going to cause more anyway. So you have to factor that. I know I do.
Well, yeah, definitely. Obviously, you know, not being able to practice due to COVID.
You shouldn't.
Yeah, you know, obviously not being able to practice due to COVID is definitely going to have a huge impact on in terms of players being able to stay in shape and everything.
Right.
Now the Jets, they signed kicker Eddie Pinheiro after releasing their previous kicker Alex Kessman. After releasing their other previous kicker, Matt Amendola, for some reason. And then they brought in a kicker who had never kicked in the NFL. He shanked two extra points last week against the Eagles.
And oh, this will be fine.
So now they bring in Pinheiro, who made 82.1% of his field goal tries in 2019 for Chicago. I mean, the Jets are basically dealing with scraps. But, hey, who knows? Maybe this is going to be a Nick Folk situation for you guys where, you know, the Patriots were in sort of the same issue a couple years ago, and all of a sudden they brought in Nick Folk, and Nick Folk all of a sudden has become Mr. Dependable. For field goals for the Patriots. So maybe this might be a Nick Folk situation for the New York Jets.
Yeah, then they're all going to say, Folk you. Oh, okay.
In other news, the NFL upheld Deontay Harris's 3-game suspension for a DUI. He appealed the suspension near the end of November, so his appeal was unsuccessful, and now he will miss the next 3 games for the New Orleans Saints. He will be eligible to return in Week 17. He had played a mix of special teams and wide receivers this year, often looking like the most explosive pass catcher in New Orleans. So now it looks like Tre'Quan Smith and Marquez Callaway will continue playing full-time roles in Harris's absence. Also, kind of bad news for the Dallas Cowboys. Tony Pollard revealed that he has been diagnosed with a torn plantar fascia in his left foot, and he is considered to be a game-time decision for tomorrow's game against Washington. And he said that he does remain in pain a week after the fact. They say once you tear it, it actually heals better and you don't feel it as much. And he said, I'm still waiting until I get to that point. But a lot of people are considering him to be on the wrong side of questionable. following this new information. So,
yeah.
It says the rest required to make it better is measured in months, not weeks. So he could potentially be a game time decision for pretty much the rest of the year, from what it sounds like.
Okay, that's not good. That's not good.
Because if you remember, Peyton Manning, well, it's obviously different with quarterbacks because you have to have you have to plant with your foot, you know, to make throws. With Peyton Manning, when he suffered a torn plantar, when he had plantar fasciitis, when he was a Bronco, he had to undergo surgery, or I believe, or maybe he had to go through rehab or something. But he ended up missing like most of the season, and that's eventually, you know, what opened the door for. I forget who it was, but. It opened the door for his backup to basically seemingly make it look like, well, hell, maybe he's the Broncos quarterback of the future after leading the Broncos to the playoffs, only for Peyton Manning to then take over in time for the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Speaking of kickers, the Raiders, they signed kicker Daniel Carlson to a 4-year, $18.4 million extension, which will put him in a Raiders uniform through the 2025 season. He is currently playing this year on the restricted free agent tender, and after flaming out with the Vikings, he has found a long-term home with Vegas, connecting on 27 of 30 attempts on field goals this year, which is good for 90%, and has missed just 2 of his 25 extra points. So now at $4.6 million per year, he is considered to be the league's third highest paid kicker. And also, Texans head coach David Culley has said that Davis Mills will start for the rest of this season because he, quote-unquote, gives the team the best chance to win over Tyrod, over the original starter, Tyrod Taylor. It said, so basically, he had pretended that Tyrod Taylor's wrist injury had forced the team to start Mills, but he said, basically, you've seen the last three games we've played. It just hasn't been good enough. When asked about the rest of his season commitment to Mills, who was a third-round rookie this year. So now it's the third time in 3 years that Taylor has been benched for a rookie. Now the team turns back to Mills, who had 7 touchdown passes to 8 interceptions this year. So it's still going to – they're still likely to remain one of the league's run-heaviest offenses, and they have the NFL's 5th lowest pass rate since Week 10. So he's nothing more than a last-ditch option, basically, for a team that's struggling to hang on to active quarterback. And also, after a story that was put out there that Russell Wilson would reportedly waive his no-trade clause for specific teams, he reiterated that he wants to play in Seattle for, and he put it this way, 20 years, and he called the report a non-story.
Non-story? I never heard.
Yeah, he called the report a non-story after it said that he would waive his no-trade clause to play for the Giants, the Eagles, and there were a couple of other teams that were in the mix as well. But, you know, I found it kind of weird that all of a sudden it would pop up like this when, you know, when he's basically been the franchise player of the Seahawks ever since he got drafted. So for him to for a story to all of a sudden leak out about who he would accept trades to, it just didn't make sense at all.
Yeah.
Considering considering he is still considered to be one of the better quarterbacks in the league. And Seattle just has to – I mean, he has two great receivers in Lockett and Metcalf. So, I mean, yeah, they have a 4-8 record this year, but – I mean, you could kind of say that's maybe more on the defense than on the offense.
Yes. Hey,
so,
you know,
I mean,
there is one thing I wanted to bring up before we go. I know you – well, you do follow MLS soccer, I think, somewhat, right?
Yes. Yes, I heard about NYCFC.
We had the final today, and you would not believe how this game ended. Wow. I mean, look, NYFC was up 1-0 for much of the game. Just in the closing seconds of extra added time, Portland scores a tying goal, and they had to go to a shootout, and NYFC won it 4-2 in the shootout. I mean, for those of you who think that American soccer is not exciting, then believe me, you have missed a great game today. Boy,
you
better rethink that.
Oh, yeah, it was a
– Oh, my God.
House.
I was on the air doing that. I had the game on. And you know, we're so sure with about 30 seconds to go, I'm like, you've got to be freaking kidding. I'm like, what?
And you know, that isn't the first time, though, that they've done that this postseason, because they also almost lost the game to the New England Revolution, with New England scoring very late to tie things up. I mean, granted, it wasn't this late where it was literally seconds left in the game.
Yeah.
But, you know, the same thing kind of happened with the New England Revolution, which then forced things into penalty kicks. And I'm surprised, honestly, that they were able to get – well, obviously, you know, I'm surprised they were able to get back – they were able to get past the Revolution. I was also surprised they were able to get past the Philadelphia Union, because Philadelphia has been one of the better teams this year.
And
not just that, they got
in New York City.
Yeah, not just that, but they got past Philadelphia without their top player, without NYC's top player.
Yes.
But,
okay, that note,
I don't know.
I think we better wrap it up.
Yeah, but yeah. Thank you, Lou, for joining me as always. You know, maybe next week I can get my friend to call in. Maybe I can get my friend to call in next week, because I know he has a lot of thoughts about the Revolution, basically getting screwed out of the MLS playoffs. But that's he put it in his own words. He put it in his own words. But
before I get
anyways,
cut off.
Yep. Everybody have a good night, and you know, for those of you who haven't done so yet, you can subscribe to the Missy AE podcast by going to blogtalkradio.com/MissyAE or by subscribing on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or Amazon Music. You can do so there. You'll get access to all of our shows that we've done. Thank you guys for joining me. Join us this upcoming Thursday for the Survivor 41 finale show, where we will recap the Survivor 41 finale and everything that goes down with the final five. So everybody have a great rest of your weekend, and we will see you guys for Sports Whispers Weekly next Saturday. But for Survivor, we will see you guys this upcoming Thursday.